Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast, and I'm having trouble figuring out the day because for the first time we are taping this early. I think today is Thursday, May 14th, 2020, because we are actually doing this Wednesday near about 6 o'clock on the 13th. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Senior Writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today from lockdown in Los Angeles, where he will be under lockdown until the coming of the Messiah, Ben Shapiro. Commentary 2019 roastie Ben Shapiro, host of The Ben Shapiro Show, best-selling author, father of three, husband of a doctor. Hello, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, good. So Ben, we're excited to talk to you because you are apparently living under circumstances perhaps now even more draconian than the ones that we have been living under in New York, with your city, the Los Angeles County's health commissioner, apparently declaring that Los Angeles is going to remain under lockdown forever.
She is an illustrious health expert. This is what I have learned from her resume, which involves things like communications degrees from the University of California at Santa Cruz and education degrees from University of Massachusetts. It's very, very impressive sort of stuff. It's the experts, experts like her and Greta Thunberg that I think that we should all be really listening to at this point. We're never going to stop locking down is sort of the plan. The state of California has said that for counties to stop lockdown, you're supposed to have no casualties from COVID-19 for 14 days, which means that presumably my great-great-grandchildren one day far into the future may have the opportunity to leave their houses in Los Angeles if we don't leave first. So if you want to drive people out of LA, this is a fantastic way to do it. I checked the statistics just to see if there had been a week in LA County, which is a county of 10 million people, to see if there was a week in the past 4 years in which somebody had not died of pneumonia or the flu. There has not been, actually. So since people, it turns out, die in a county of 10 million people, I think that we should probably be welded into our homes Chinese style forever, because no one ever dies at home either is another thing that I've learned. Only if you venture out your front door will you die when a palm tree falls on you and or COVID.
So I want to ask you,
Abe, hold on a second. Yeah. Abe.
Yes.
You were listening to Andrew Cuomo today.
Yes.
And yesterday. And you, in terms of leaving your home and the danger therein, you discovered something that is kind of startling about the health stats, right?
This is true. So Cuomo, in today's daily briefing, when he gives all
today, by the way, being Wednesday. Oh, so this
Wednesday,
is yesterday's briefing as you're hearing this. Sorry, it's my fault too.
Right. He updates New Yorkers on all the latest COVID-related statistics. And in addition to new hospitalizations, new deaths, new intubations, he was discussing the breakdown of those New Yorkers in New York State tested for antibodies. And it turns out that bus drivers, prison workers, healthcare workers, and police officers all test as having, are all less likely to have, be positive for the COVID antibodies than the general population, which leads me to believe that staying home has got to be the least safe possible option, at least mathematically. I have no explanation.
The last update last week was that a full 2/3 of people who were being newly admitted into hospitals for COVID infections had been coming from home, non-essential workers not traveling, as far as anybody knows, right?
That's right. And very few, it turns out, a tiny, tiny percentage of new cases come from those who have been taking public transportation in New York City, too. Something like 2 or 3%. I just want to say, in regard to the zero case scenario before reopening that Ben was describing, I'm at least relieved to hear someone say it out loud, because that has been the implicit argument of all this that no one is saying. And whenever you say, look, whenever I say we're never going to get down to zero, people say no one's saying that we're trying to get to no cases. No one's saying that we're not going to get to no deaths. We just want to get down to a manageable point that we can then track and trace the remaining cases. But finally, it comes out. We're looking for zero. I understand the impulse. It's also not going to happen.
Ben, I want to know how long it took you to Google the directions to the Arizona border. Because on the other side of the border, the gyms are opening up at the end of the week. Pools are opening up. A lot of facilities, otherwise retail facilities and recreational facilities are open. Major sports, professional sports are going to be allowed to play. So it's a universe for a difference 4 hours away from where you are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have so many friends who are calling me within the last week and saying, we're looking at real estate outside of California. Like, they're just looking to get out. And part of that is the lockdowns, but a large part of that is the public policy combined with the lockdowns. So I have two friends inside the last 48 hours who were robbed in some way. Somebody came up to somebody's mailbox, robbed them, went through their mailbox, took their stuff. My friend Dave Rubin, that happened to a friend down the block, a couple blocks away from me. His next door neighbor, who's his brother, actually had three guys break into his house while he was home. And my good friend pulled out his shotgun because he heard his brother yelling from next door and racked the shotgun. And these three guys took off down the street. LAPD shows up and LAPD says, well, I'm not sure what the point of us investigating this is, because if we put these people in jail, there's a no bail rule in LA right now. So everybody is just going to be out on the streets immediately. So what's the point of us tracking these people who were in your brother's house down? And so my friend called me. He's like, I'm out of here, because he also happens to be a landlord out here. And one of the rules that they are now pushing in LA is that you are not supposed to pay rent. One of the real reason, the unspoken reason that they're talking about lockdown until August is not because they actually think Americans are going to lock down until August. Nobody in LA is locking down. I mean, there's traffic on the roads. I would say it's about 30% of normal. And people are out at the parks. People are going back to the office. The feet are doing the talking. But the real reason why the LA County Board of Supervisors is saying that it's locked down is they have a legal excuse now to tell people they do not have to pay rent until the beginning of August, which of course means the landlords are going to get jacked, because unlike a mortgage where you just add months to the back of the mortgage or something, when you're talking about rent, if you have a one-year lease and your lease expires, exactly how do they expect that landlords are going to go after the back rent? That's just money that's gone. It's never going to appear again. So everything is basically geared toward destroying business in the city of Los Angeles. And the media environment, which basically suggests that if you lock down more heavily, then we can never blame you for anything bad that happens, because COVID is to blame for the economic downturn, but only you allowing people to go out of your house is to blame for people buying. That logic has become so pervasive, I think, for a lot of Democratic politicians, particularly, that you're getting what I was referring to yesterday or 2 days ago on Twitter to as sort of the lockdown infinity competition that my kids play with each other, right? It's lockdown plus 100, lockdown plus 200, lockdown infinity plus one. And so Eric Garcetti is going to engage in that game with the mayor of San Francisco, I would imagine, until there are no people left here. And it'll be like Planet of the Apes. It'll be Charlton Heston just wandering the beaches looking for the Statue of Liberty.
Well, but this is a really important point, because we are at this transition period where we're starting to think about opening up and really wanting to open up, and how are different states trying to open up. Right now is exactly the moment where you're going to see people who have skin in the game with bureaucratic overreach doing just that. So this is happening in LA. It's happening. I mean, DC's mayor today, which is Wednesday, announced an extension of our lockdown. We were supposed to be out of lockdown on May 15th, and now we're going into June. But there are incentives, not just the legal ones that you mentioned, Ben, but also a kind of policy incentives for them to keep the lockdown going, right? I mean, there is, if you come from a very anti-business standpoint, which some of our civic leaders do, there's a weird kind of schadenfreude watching all this stuff happen, right? If you think that people who own property and rent it out are evil, again, you'll see this as a kind of, you know, karmic comeuppance in a way. And some of the language you're seeing coming from these leaders now hints at that. And I expect within a few weeks we'll be seeing them be a lot more honest about it.
Well, that's depressing.
Sorry.
Let's face it. No,
I mean, my lockdown extended. I'm depressed.
I understand. But I think it's very interesting about rent, because you know, the hatred of the landlord is a sort of trope dating back forever on the left, and has this idea supporting it that there is something illegitimate about having to pay for where you live or having to pay for where you work, that it's like a human right to be able to have your own, have something that's your own that you don't have to pay for. And yet, I think particularly in a city like Los Angeles, and certainly, by the way, in a city like New York, where I think there's less of this, the pressure was always on forbidding landlords from raising rent. That's the game in New York. But that, you know, how many homeowners rent out a basement apartment? How many people Yep. rent out, you know, one place, own something and rent something else out? And are looking at, and they're like they're the same as everybody else. They have to pay. They have to pay for upkeep and to defray their own mortgage costs on a property they own, and then they're out that money. And then in 3 months, there can be proceedings against them because they're not renters; they're owners. And then Right. the property can be seized for non-payment or a lien put on it or something like that, and then they're ruined.
Well, I think there are a lot of people. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people who are very, very excited at the ability to try out theories that they've had in their heads but have never actually gotten a chance to try out. So we're sort of seeing this on a broad national level with modern monetary theory, the idea that we can just spend endlessly and there will never be any consequences to it. And so Nancy Pelosi is proposing a $3 trillion package that is chock full of goodies like let's bail out all the states that signed crappy pension contracts. But on a rent level, on a land, you know, dealing with landlords level, I don't know if you guys saw that editorial in your paper of note in your very parochial New York Times, basically suggesting that the big problem in New York with the future of New York is the stratification of the city of New York. And what really needs to happen is the government needs to pay to build affordable housing in the richer enclaves of New York City to make sure that the people who are in the poorer enclaves of New York City, which have health inequalities, but they call them health inequities, are able to move into richer areas. So this is not going to have the very predictable externality of everybody in the richer areas promptly picking up and leaving New York City, which is exactly, of course, what happened in the 1970s and 1980s when people tried affordable housing policies. It's pretty incredible to watch, you know, people use this pandemic as an excuse to enact their priors. And that's why you're seeing the backlash. I really do think that the backlash is only going to grow stronger because we're all willing to go along with this. I was willing to go along with this. I'm kind of cautious and risk averse by nature. I have parents who are 64. I'm willing to go along with lockdown so long as I think that the policy is actually geared toward protecting people. I'm not willing to go along with lockdown when I feel that the policy has now shifted into don't let a good crisis go to waste. And I'm increasingly feeling that from
well, lockdown. I want to talk about that a little bit because what sense do you get to the extent you can, you're in touch with it? From the ground that these conditions are tolerable. The media environment nationally is to regard anybody who questions or is chafes under these very intense lockdown provisions as a rump, you know, a dismissible group of, you know, malcontents who otherwise don't represent virtually anyone. And a little further down the coast, you had something of a protest movement down in Huntington a couple of weeks back. When the beaches were being closed, and only now are they being reopened. You're not allowed to sit on your beach, by the way. The beaches right. are open by you, but you can't sit on them. Lord knows how they're going to enforce that.
I'm going to fire my children from a cannon, from the back of my car, into the ocean. And then my plan is to immediately jump in after them and pick them up and throw them back in the car. No towels or anything. If their feet touch the ground is lava. If their feet touch the ground, then they have sinned against the city of Los Angeles and must therefore be given inhuman sacrifice, like they're residents of the city of the state of Georgia. So I'm very excited to.
You'll shed some calories, some lockdown weight. You'll get rid of it.
It's very exciting stuff. Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to understand. I mean, you guys are in on the East Coast and DC, so you understand the capacity for hypocrisy. But there's a reason that California has the highest taxes in America and also the highest number of deductions taken on federal taxation. And the same thing holds true when it comes to the lockdown policies. If you ask Californians, how many of you are pro-lockdown? They'd be like, yeah, absolutely. We got to do what we can in order to slow the spread. It's really important. We keep hearing from the experts, not like that Trump and those crazy right-wingers. We got to do what we can to lock this thing down. And these are people who just don't care about human life. And then, dude, it's 85 degrees outside. Like, it's really nice out here. And it's a Sunday. And you know what? I'm going to the beach. the amazing capacity to hold those two thoughts at once. I don't think it's unique to LA. I think you're starting to see it across the country. And so I frankly don't trust a lot of the polling data on this stuff. I also don't trust how the polls are worded. I think that a lot of the polling is worded like, are you ready to come out before it is safe? Or are you willing to lock down until it is safe? And those that binary wording is completely ridiculous. I mean, the actual question is, are you willing to come out of your home if you are guaranteed that if you're below the age of 40 and your chances of death are 2 in 10,000, are you willing to come out of your house? And the answer there is yes. And by the way, those are the actual odds of you dying if you're under the age of 40 and you don't have a pre-existing health condition. So my biggest bugaboo in all of this is the refusal of public health officials to actually explain your risk factor based on the population group to which you belong. You'll hear people from the Washington Post say things like, if you're 80 years old, yeah, there's a good probability that you're going to get sick and you might die. But if you're younger, it could happen to you, too. It could happen to you, too. I mean, like, I'm sorry, if you're 81 years old, yes, there's a better probability that you're going to die overall. Forget COVID-19. And if you're 30, you could also die. But we all understand that the odds are slightly different.
I think the hypocrisy that we're talking about is a very telling one, too, because I think it stems from this idea that, yes, I want the state to keep me safe. It's the state's responsibility to look after me, do what it can. It messed this up in the first place. Me, I'm that's a different story. I'm going out, but it's not up to me. It's up to them.
But this is a classic look. This is a classic problem that of course crosses ideological lines, but somehow seems, I would say, not just to us because of our ideological predispositions, but because of the nature of these things, to be much more delicious when you see it happening with liberals, which is to say, Neil Ferguson, not the historian, but the epidemiologist in England, having to quit, having established the, you know, nightmare scenario baseline of 2 million people dead, not being socially distanced from his mistress, with whom he did not live.
Paramore was his mistress.
Paramore, that's right. Okay, so he has to quit, right? It's like Lori David, Larry David's wife, the sort of global warming extremist who flies private on her jet and burns up, 20,000 gallons of fuel, because she wants to go get, she wants to see her private shopper at Bergdorf in New York. Those kinds of stories, the limousine liberal, the classic limousine liberalism hypocrisy, whatever errors and horrible mistakes in hypocrisy that are made on the right, they're not these ones. It's not precisely this kind of, you must live in a certain way because I command it because of what is good for everybody else. But of course, I'll just do what I want privately. Yeah, there's like the great story of Yitzhak Rabin, the sainted, now dead, assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. 20 years before he was the saint, before his assassination, he was his first go-round as prime minister of Israel. In the middle of an economic crisis, he declared that no one in the country could have a foreign bank account. Couldn't have a foreign bank account because that wasn't right. And then it turned out that his wife had $25,000 in a bank in Washington. And he had to resign. But if he hadn't had to, it wasn't like, it was like, hey, Leah, you better close that account. It was like, well, I don't have to close my account. Everybody else has to close their account, but I don't have to close my account. I'm sorry, I just lost my mic. Sorry, fell out of my ear. This is a thing. This is a big thing, and I don't think it means that individual people who say, yeah, we should have the lockdowns, but I'm not going to follow them, are the problem. The problem is leadership. But I do think that the incentives have to shift for the politicians to believe that it is worse for them to advocate lockdown in perpetuity than it is for them to open up or to say, and the only way, because of the establishment of these rules, this zero fatality rule, and I've been saying this, you know, for a couple of months, is somehow there has to be a conspiracy to deem the problem fixed.
Well, this is wild. The California example is wildly outside the norm.
Right.
Yeah, what we're experiencing on the what we experience in the New York area and what you experience, Ben, in California isn't anything like what they experience in the South, for example, or the middle of the country, or Texas, or Florida. Today at 5 p.m., Larry Hogan of Maryland is allowing barbershops, retail, and salons to reopen at 50% capacity, and allowing churches to hold services outdoors recommended, but it's not, you know, not a hard and fast rule because no one's going to enforce that. And it's starting to ease around the country. The press is not just not keeping up with these developments. They're bicoastal themselves.
I think one of the ways this is actually going to get quite ugly is, you know, you guys have been pointing out on the podcast that there is no mechanism of enforcement for these sorts of orders, that a lot of this is a flex. And that's right. But the problem is that at a certain point, the pedal is going to hit the metal and there will have to either be enforcement or no enforcement. And all it's going to take is one really bad incident for all of this to fall in on itself very, very quickly. And you started to see that a little bit in New York when there was that tape of the black gentleman who was being basically mauled by members of the NYPD for not socially distancing. All it takes is for one of those incidents to not end in just a tape of somebody being mauled, but an Eric Garner type situation, for all of this to end extremely, extremely fast.
You know, I wish that was right, and I don't think it is. I followed this story really closely. I wrote about it for the website and the magazine. The hypocrisies of this lockdown are along racial lines, are pitting these two very non-negotiable competing values against each other, racial equality before the law and public health. And guess what? What did the city side with? Public health. They decided not to ease the restrictions that they were policing minority parts of the city and poorer parts of the city and relax those restrictions commensurate with what they were doing on Chelsea Pierce. No, they applied that standard that they were applying to the rest of the poorer parts of the city to Chelsea Pierce. And which was met, by the way, with great satisfaction from most of the city, which wanted to be policed more heavily and to demonstrate solidarity with the rest of the city, which they were not experiencing that kind of effect. So, no, I don't think that's what's going to do it. Even violence, I don't think that's what's going to do it. It will have to be a mass movement, my view.
I think Ben's onto something, though. I do think that a couple of really bad things happening will have the effect of making people say, all right, well, you know, you can't really enforce a rule that says that people shouldn't be outside in the summer. Like, you just can't do that. It's not good for the kids. It's really unhealthy for the kids. And I think that some of that pressure, if you think about it, granted, this is now 6 weeks away I'm talking about here, but June 30th, is the end of the fiscal year for a lot of people. It will be the end of the second quarter. And it is a moment when, it will be the moment when nonprofits all across the country will be flooding our mailboxes with the, please, you know, please send in your money so we can close this quarter out. It'll be, you know, and help us. And the numbers are going to be catastrophic. I mean, the numbers, the nonprofit numbers are going to be catastrophic. The academic numbers, foundation numbers, food bank number, it's going to be a wipeout, extinction level moment for a lot of people and a lot of organizations and a lot of bad organizations and a lot of good organizations. And this is where I think this conspiracy that won't be a conspiracy could emerge from, which is, oh my God, we know a lot of people are unemployed. We know it's terrible. We know that the economy is contracting and all of this. And we know that all these restaurants have closed, right? Or these movie theaters have closed or whatever. But now the entire social service structure inside the United States that is not public is being hit by an extinction level event. We can't go on this way. It cannot go on. And somehow the body of opinion that is controlled by that group of people will decide that we've really done a fantastic job flattening the curve and answering the call, and this really was a kind of yay, America, you did it, what a noble sacrifice you've made. Let's get going again.
Because I think it'll hit the media first. I think it'll hit the media because, you know, it's easy for Chris. Nobody works for Chris Cuomo, right? Chris Cuomo works for somebody else. So he has the luxury of the same luxury that we all have of doing his job from home. But what happens when the ad revenue completely collapses? I mean, in the end, CNN is still reliant on ad revenue. I mean, all of these media companies are relying on subscriptions right now, and subscriptions have not dropped off. They've gone up because people's consumption of news is still very strong. But what happens when people stop getting the checks from the government and they have to start prioritizing their spending? One of the first things that's going to go is the subscription model. Advertising dollars are already just plummeting. I mean, you can see it online. You're already seeing all sorts of, and we have great traffic over at Daily Wire. Ad revenue has been cut in half because the advertising online is just gone. And that's true for virtually everybody. And there's going to come a point here where the level of comfort that it takes to be able to say it's not important for people to go back to work, all that matters is that we risk mitigate, that starts to drop off for people fairly quickly. Because what you've started to see, and this is particularly true for people in the sort of top income quintile, is a split between people who are the employees in the top income quintile and the people who are the employers in the top income quintile. You've started to see people, even in Hollywood, you know, the Jeffrey Katzenbergs of the world going, guys, we're getting wrecked out here, right? The heads of Disney are ready for reopening. I mean, they're just getting wrecked. And so the people who work for Disney, right, all the people who are over at ABC News are getting their check. And so it doesn't matter to them. You know, for them, it's like, okay, well, you know, we're here to save lives and we're the news people. But guess what? Somebody's signing the check for them too. And when the ad revenue drops and when BuzzFeed just had to cut their entire UK and Australia operation, and when you're gonna start seeing a contraction that so far is it started at the low level with local news, and it is moving up the chain, up the food chain to national news. And when that happens, it would not surprise me at all to start seeing a little bit of a shift in the nature of the coverage from the self-righteous, the only rich people who are calling for reopening are people who don't care about the black and the impoverished, to, well, look, this is hurting everybody. Everybody's really getting hurt here, and we really got to reopen.
Well, who? Gee, what I country?
I was trying to be so, you know, so thoughtful about the need for social service organizations, uh-huh. And here you're going right at
cynical.
The jobs. You know, Abe, I gotta pause for a second, sure. If I could, because I want to talk to you guys about our new advertiser, Gabby Insurance. Okay, because we're all looking for ways to save money, especially now. When's the last time you looked at how much you're spending every month on car insurance, on homeowners insurance? Now's the time to check out Gabby, G-A-B-I, and see about getting a lower rate for the exact same coverage you already have. Gabby takes the pain out of shopping for insurance by giving you an apples-to-apples comparison of your current coverage with 40 of the top insurance providers like Progressive, Nationwide, and Travelers. Just link your current insurance account, and in about 2 minutes, you'll be able to see quotes for the exact same coverage you currently have. Let me just tell you a quick story about my parents, my sister, and my parents. My sister was going through some of my parents' papers and took a look at their homeowners insurance and discovered that my parents, who live in an apartment in New York City, were paying for to insure a gun collection and their mausoleum. And some other things that were on this policy. And so she then had to start comparison shopping to get them a better insurance rate that they had been paying, because for some reason they had enlisted themselves in this ridiculously grand insurance policy. And if she had had Gabby, I think that would have been pretty helpful for her, in fact. And if I'd known about it when she did it, I would have had her use Gabby, because Gabby's customers save $825 per year on average. If they can't find you savings like they did for the way my sister found, they'll let you know so you can relax knowing you have had the best rate out there. And they'll never sell your info, so no annoying spam or robocalls. It's totally free to check your rate. There's no obligation. Take 2 minutes right now to see how much you can save on your car and homeowners insurance. Go to gabby.com/commentary. That's gabby.com/commentary, gabby.com/commentary. And we thank Gabby Insurance for sponsoring the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Abe, I'm sorry I interrupted
right.
you.
That's okay. I want to jump right in on Ben's point about, well, who is it exactly who wants to reopen and kill people out of greed? Is it the anti-science deplorables, or is it the media elites? I'm looking at three headlines all within the past 24 hours. Film and TV production gets green light in Spain. Read the extensive safety precautions. Film and TV production to resume in the UK, but must follow social distancing rules. And Poland to host Netflix, HBO, and Warner Brothers projects gives green light for film and TV. So media is going back into business on the with one hand, while the other hand is scolding those of us who want to reopen.
Well, entertainment is going into business. Media has never not been in business. Media has never felt
true too.
Hasn't right. felt the pain of this yet, which is the point.
I find this all fascinating in this one regard. Look, you know, on yesterday's podcast, we had a bit of a lemon session against Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things, and his claim that, you know, forcing people to wear that people wearing masks is an act of cowardice, and that, you know, this is not what the Greatest Generation did, and all of that. And that I said, look, if you want to reopen the country, you can't just pretend that there isn't a virus out there. So there are things that you're going to do. It's weird to be almost hysterical about wanting the country to open up and hysterical about the measures that people take prudently to try to contain the spread of the virus as we open up. And that this is, you know, but for some reason, people who have this attitude seem to be unwilling either to take the measures that seem to be helpful in the opening up process.
Well, I do think that there is a question here. And the question is due to the vagary of what exactly it is that we are attempting to do. So nobody has been very clear about what even we are really trying to do with the social distancing and the mask wearing. They keep saying things like slow the spread, but originally, the goal of slow the spread was the same as flatten the curve, which is don't overwhelm the healthcare system. Right. So if the idea is that you actually, like, what are we hoping for here? Are we hoping for a therapeutic that's going to come along and really reduce the death rate? Are we hoping for a vaccine that's going to be developed in the next 6 months? How realistic are any of those things? Are we waiting for a deus ex machina? If you're not waiting for a deus ex machina, if you think that basically this is what it is, and there's not going to be a serious therapeutic, that the hopes for a vaccine might be a pipe dream, then basically you actually want young, healthy people to go have a coronavirus party, right? And I think that there are some people who have started to advocate for that. And I think that that's kind of what you're seeing there, which is not go to a nursing home and don't wear a mask. But to be fair, you know, some people saying if you're 20 years old and you're wearing a mask because you're worried about your own protection, or you're hanging out with other 20-year-olds and you're afraid that you're going to get COVID-19, that you are actually reducing the chances of reaching herd immunity. Now, that may be over-intellectualizing what seemed to be a visceral, you know, gut roar from the testosterone-driven areas of the human body. But I think that there is a case to be made. There were theorists in Israel who were positing this, basically a theory called controlled avalanche, like a ski resort where you kind of detonate a few small avalanches to avoid having a giant avalanche that overwhelms. Basically lock up the nursing homes. And then if herd immunity rate is 60%, you want to reach that 60% among the least vulnerable populations rather than letting the 60% sort of fall where it may among the vulnerable and the invulnerable. And again, it's not clear to me exactly what people are attempting to do. I think the answer is buy time, but I think that people need to be clear that that's the answer, that what they're attempting to do is buy time. And they're not being clear about that because they then cannot give forecast as to the vaccinations. Like a couple of days ago, Mitt Romney was asking Fauci about the vaccinations. And he was saying, what do you think are the chances that we develop a vaccine in 18 months? You know, good, very good, bad, mediocre, terrible. And Fauci sort of ran. He said, okay, well, how about inside 12 months? And then Fauci gave his number. That's not the question. The question is, what are the chances that we're going to develop a vaccine inside 6 months? Okay, if the idea is that we're supposed to basically lock down and or socially distance to the ultimate extent for 12 months, I honestly do not think that even the mask wearing and the social distancing are going to last a year. I just don't. I don't think that people have the capacity. Also, we all have children, or at least a lot of us have children. Like, have you ever seen a child try to socially distance? I mean, that's insane. I mean, here's the reality. Once the schools are open, all this crap is over. Okay, once the schools are open, this is all done. Every virus I've gotten in the last 6 years since my daughter was born has come directly from my daughter. These kids are little germ factories interacting with other little germ factories and drooling all over each other. So you best pray that children can't infect adults. Or basically all of this is a moot point because the kids are going to go back to school. They're all going to get each other sick. And then they're going to come home and they're going to get everybody else sick. At which point it's like, okay, you better have protected the nursing homes. So I don't know. The more I see this, the more I feel like we're all going to end up where Sweden is, except because this is America. Large swaths of America are not quite as compliant as the people in Sweden. And even in Sweden, by the way, the notion that everybody there is super compliant about wearing masks and socially distancing is not actually true. There are a lot of people there who are not wearing masks or socially distancing.
Well, and there's the interesting thing, too, since we were talking a little bit about the media narrative, there's also been kind of only two registers in which anyone seems to be able to perform their feelings about this, right? So you have DeSantis in Florida, for example. My parents live in Florida. He did shut down, you know, he did prohibit visits to nursing homes. The other thing he did is stop, you know, Airbnb style rentals. You know, you had to rent for a certain amount of time. This was a very smart thing to do because it stopped people from bringing the virus further into the state. We didn't hear a lot about, we heard a lot of criticism of DeSantis's policies, but in retrospect, certainly the nursing home decision was crucial for keeping their death rates where they are now. So you have this sort of hysteria among the media of not, you know, and partisanship about not wanting to hear in another register something going well after you've decided on what the melody is supposed to be. On the other hand, you know, I think for the average American, and I think we've all seen this for the advertising we've gotten in the last, you know, few months, every single advertisement begins with, you know, like a weepy violin music and saying, in these difficult times, and like, they're all the same. And you can't, that can't go on either. So there's this, and I think Americans have a really wonderful impulse when there's some sort of tragedy or disaster to act. Like, we're very pragmatic and action-oriented, pragmatic about policy solutions and more action-oriented in crises. And this is not that quite that kind of crisis, right? It's extensive. It's dragging out. We're a little confused about, you know, how to handle it. It's a whole new thing. So I think that the messaging there is for the average American who just wants to figure out, is my kid going to be able to go back to school in the fall? This is where the policy confusion comes in. And this is, I do think there is a lack of leadership at the top in terms of the reassurance as well as some practical signposts. If our kids can't go back to school in the fall, John, I think you said this weeks ago, we're in much bigger trouble than we are right now.
I have adopted a conspiracy theory that I can't shake, which is the profound, inexcusable, inexplicable lack of curiosity about New York State's handling of nursing homes. Which resulted the executive order from the governor forcing these nursing homes to accept patients from hospitals, whether they're positive or not, you don't necessarily know. And over 5,000 elderly in these senior care facilities have died as a result of this. We don't have any firm questioning of the governor about why he did this, which is not to say there is no reason to do that. You could make a very bloodless calculation that people on the very upper end of actuarial tables cannot be clogging up these facilities amid an existential crisis like this. That would be a valid, responsible thing to do, even though it's absolutely disastrous for the people who inhabit these facilities, inexcusable for their relatives, but nevertheless understandable. But he should be made to explain himself. And has not been made to explain himself, because if you were to do so, you would expose it for the last outrage cycle we just lived through, which is you're killing grandma. That performative nonsense that we all had to experience for anybody who wanted to dare open up facilities for some 50% capacity facilities, that you were willingly subjecting seniors to a blood orgy. And that narrative would collapse if they were to ask the governor a pointed question about one of his policies.
Well, look, seriatim. What happened was that there was an astonishing confusion in March, right? Which was, we've got to flatten the curve. And it turned out that nobody actually understood what flattening the curve was. Like Ben said, flattening the curve was about making sure that the healthcare system did not collapse with a wave of patients with corona at hospitals, making it impossible for hospitals to function. So we needed to do that to save the healthcare system. Right. And that is actually why people were sent to nursing homes with corona, because the idea was they cannot be treated in emergency rooms because there aren't enough. There isn't the facilities can't handle it. The hospitals can't handle it. Make them go somewhere else. And then we also had the ventilator crisis. Remember, we need ventilators. We need 40,000 ventilators. In New York State. Well, it turned out we didn't need 40,000 ventilators. And what's more, it turns out that ventilators are a horrifically bad way to perform triage against a virus like this. Once you put someone on a ventilator, they have an 80% chance of never coming off the ventilator and dying on the ventilator in a really unpleasant way. But we didn't know that because we're not all health experts. And by the way, neither is Andrew Cuomo, and neither was Trump, and neither was anybody. And there was this kind of, we have to do this to flatten the curve. Where are the ventilators? We need the ventilators. Policy decisions were made that in retrospect are going to look, once people decide that they can look at it, are going to have looked horrifically bad and entirely, in my view, defensible, in the sense that they were horrifically bad, but they were entered into in good faith because people were legitimately and genuinely frightened about something terrible happening that, as it happens, didn't actually happen.
Listen, I understand and I agree. We had some forbearance here, but you can't decline to ask the question under the presumption that some people will act in bad faith and interpret it in the worst possible way. That's an abdication of your job.
Apparently you can.
Well,
I mean, it is amazing to see the differential media coverage on some of these stories. And the fact that DeSantis has been made a pariah by the media, and obviously his governorship has been significantly more successful than the garbage governorship of your governor, Andrew Cuomo, is truly astonishing. I mean, the amount of attention paid to Kelly Loeffler in what are suspicious but not necessarily dispositively bad circumstances versus this story out of the New York Post today, you saw this story in the New York Post about the Pennsylvania health official who was implementing an actual policy that if you were diagnosed with COVID-19 and you were in an old age home, you went back to the old age home. And then meanwhile, this person's 95-year-old mother said, I want to come out of the old age home. And so this Pennsylvania health official was like, okay, sure, come on out. So removed mom from the old age home in the middle of putting people with COVID-19 back in the old age homes. Like that kind of stuff. I just don't know how you expect Americans to pay attention to this kind of authority. And I think that there are a lot of people who right now are talking about the new normal and what's new normal going to be like. And we're comparing it to 9/11 and how we all accepted sort of what the TSA was doing. Okay, we accepted what the TSA was doing because we literally had no choice, because it was a restricted mode of travel, and most of us don't have an airplane in our backyard. And so the question was, are you going to walk through this stupid metal detector for performative security reasons and then get on an airplane, or are you just not going to fly? But when it comes to, are you going to wake up each morning and put a mask on? Are you going to wake up each morning and socially distance from each other 6 feet, like on a voluntary level, every moment of every day? I just don't think that, it is more likely that people's new normal is going to look exactly like the old normal. And people are just going to be, at a certain point, people get lazy. At a certain point, this becomes background noise. At a certain point, even 1,500 deaths a day is going to become background noise after months and months and months of this. And it's going to become even more background noise when people don't have jobs and when the government checks aren't arriving, right, and when they can, and when the supply lines break, and people are just going to say, okay, fine, listen, if you're older and you're vulnerable, let's get you an N95 mask and you can make the decision to stay home. But guess what? I'm taking my kid to a ball game. Like I've actually shifted my mind on this. I think that 3 months ago, when this started, I was fully on board with the idea that there was going to be, you know, sort of a change in the American mentality about things on a permanent level. And I'm just not seeing it. Maybe the handshake goes away permanently, but I think that may be all. I think the idea that we're all going to stay away from restaurants and we're all going to be socially distancing in restaurants and treating each other and mask wearing, like, it's just not in the American spirit, I really don't think, to mask wear for very long. Maybe in New York City you'll be able to get away with it. Maybe in San Francisco.
Handshake's coming back. That's the hill I'm going to die on.
I think you're right. I think you're probably right.
See, I agree. But again, I think the ultimate question is, what is the margin of disaster? That's what we don't know. Meaning, most people are going to go back, and for most people, nothing is going to change, or they're going to go back. But if 10% of people don't go back, is that the margin between a successful economy and a depression? And that's, I think, what we don't know. Because what is a profit margin in the United States? What does it require? What is the sort of the economic version of herd immunity by which you have enough people to support an entire economy if 10 or 15% of them basically become hermits, you know, for the next for the foreseeable future.
Well, the scenario you're outlining is one in which the public policy and media and elites are all on board with the notion that we all need to open up immediately. That's the smart thing to do because the disaster is too profound. So it will at some point become your patriotic duty to purchase, to patronize, to go back to work, to ride a bus. That's the sort of thing that there will be a public relations campaign promoting.
I just think that there is an emotional trauma associated with this, with a certain type of person, not an American, a human type, which is somebody who lives in fear of disease, of contagion, of, you know, germs, of all that. It's a certain type, and we don't know how many people it is, but it's not, you know, they're not preppers, you know, they're not birchers and they're not greener. They're not, you know, they're not 4chan people. This is a real thing. And these are people who have now had a moment in life in which their worst fear has been realized. They have been told that there is a pandemic that is going to kill people with a virus that is unstoppable. And can they recover?
I also wonder, however, whether that group of people, the people who are most risk averse, were already the people who they tend not to be the people who go out to big parties. That group of people that you're talking about may already be located in the substrate of people who actually are most vulnerable and may actually have pretty good reason to stay indoors. I mean, I think there's a hypochondriacal part of American society, but it seems to me that when we see these videos from Chicago of literally 1,000 people crammed into a small room for a party, yeah, right? Those are never the ones. It's always the Jews in Williamsburg who get all the media. But the same week that was happening, there were a couple of huge parties of disproportionately Black folks in South Side of Chicago partying. Like, I think that the people who are tending most to go out and patronize in the economy will continue to patronize and go out in the economy. I don't think that the level of caution, the people who are the most cautious and risk averse, in other words, may not be the ones who actually drive a consumption-based economy.
Right.
I think they tend to drive the investment-based economy, but I'm not sure they tend to drive the consumption-based economy.
This will be old news by the time you hear this, listeners, but as of this moment, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled that Governor Tony Evers' administration's extension of their stay-at-home order overstepped his authority and has been overruled and repealed.
Whoa.
Wow.
By the way, this is deeply important to me. Can I explain to you?
Yes,
if you listen,
sure.
If you listened to me earlier this week when I did my whole passionate defense and support of Camp Ramah in Wisconsin, one of the reasons that Camp Ramah in Wisconsin might not gather this summer was precisely Governor Tony Evers' shelter in place order not being present through the end of May, which made it impossible to plan in case it was possible for them to reopen. So this could be a very big moment for me personally and for the people who are part of my circle of people for whom this is a very important thing. So thank you for that, Noah. Now, a follow-up,
you're
update
welcome.
On the Camp Ramah story that I'm sure thrilled millions of listeners. So, hey, Ben Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us. The passionate defense of the herd immunity strategy, which we haven't really gone into in any great detail.
Now I'm going to buy it back a little bit. I think passionate defense of the herd immunity strategy might be a little
Let's say you're floating the trial balloon. You're floating the trial balloon.
For the folks over at Media Matters, I did not say that you should go to an old age home and smother grandma for herd immunity, all right?
Thank you. You did not. And it's very important that they know that. Anyway, Ben, it was great to have you. And for Abe, Christina, Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.